The House Property Tax Division is now called to order and pursuant with Rule 10.01. The first order of business is that we need to a roll call to determine who's present. The clerk, Mr. Peterson, will now take the roll.
Joaquin?
Present.
Joaquin, present. Vice Chair Gomez?
Gomez, present.
Gomez, present. Representative Hertas? Representative Hertas? Representative Anderson.
Anderson present.
Anderson present. Representative Becker Finn is excused. Representative Fisher.
Fisher present.
Fisher present. Representative Green.
Present.
Green present. Representative Hassan.
Hassan is here.
Hassan present. Representative Herr. Representative Herr. Representative Marquardt.
Marquardt present.
Marquardt present. Representative Mortensen.
Mortensen present.
Mortensen present. Representative Pulaski.
Pulaski present.
Pulaski present. Representative Torkelson.
Torkelson present.
Torkelson present. Representative Hertas.
Hertas present.
Hertas present. And Representative Herr. Madam Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. I want to note that all the committee documents for today have been sent to members and are on the committee page on the House website. When this hearing was posted, the public was provided with instruction on how to sign up to testify. During the public portion of the bill hearing, we had 11 members of the public sign up to testify today. First item on our agenda is the approval of the minutes from March 23rd. Representative Marquardt, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I did, Madam Chair. I'll move approval of those minutes.
Wonderful. Thank you. Chair Marquardt moves the approval of the minutes. Does anyone have any questions on the minutes? Seeing none, with that, members, we're going to do a voice vote. All those, so unmute yourself, please. All those in favor of approving the minutes for March 23rd, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, please say no. The minutes are adopted. Members, give me 2 seconds. I have something stuck in my throat. Thank you, members, for your patience. A drink of water always helps, right? So today, members, we are going to go over the division report, which is being amended onto House File 4064. We are going to have the staff walk through the divisions with the division report with the article with breaks after each article for questions from members, and then questions at the end. So currently, I will move House File 4064 back before the division. I will also move the A22-0389 amendment. That amendment is the Property Tax Division Report. If it is all right with members, we will adopt the amendment to put the bill in the right shape and then have, like I said, nonpartisan staff walk through the bill and with public testimony afterwards. Are there any questions on the plan for today's hearing before we move ahead? Seeing none, we will take a voice vote on the A22-0389 amendment. So please momentarily unmute yourself. All those in favor of adopting the amendment, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the A22-0389 amendment is adopted. Members, I'm just going to briefly talk about the bill and then hand it over to nonpartisan staff. We have before us today the Property Tax Division Report. The bill before you reflects the work that committee and its members have done over the last 8 weeks. I would like to thank the members for their participation and the discussions we have had. Many more bills were introduced than we had time to hear, but we did fit in a lot of work in over the 11 committee hearing time slots that we had. And thanks to Chair Markert for giving us a few of the tax time slots. One of the major tasks that we have in this division is to make sure that our property tax system has a sense of fairness and equity. Through the property tax refund program, homestead exclusions, targeted property tax credits, renters credits, senior deferral programs, and others, we provide homeowners and renters with money to offset a portion of their local property taxes. Through local government and county program aid, we send assistance to our counties and cities across the state so that they can provide needed services to their communities. As a division, we also support our schools with levy equalization for those communities that have lower property values. The legislation before you makes investments in all of those programs. The bill also provides tax increment financing flexibility to our cities, and a cleanup requested by the state auditor has provisions that address local option sales tax and a lodging tax for our cities and counties and a few more items. I will touch on just a few highlights before we move over to nonpartisan staff. The largest investment, nearly two-thirds of our budget, goes to a very transformational change in the renter's credit. We move the income calculation from the complicated household income to the adjusted gross income, as well as moving this program onto the income tax form so people can get their refunds faster. I would like to thank Representative Gomez, Representative Agbaje, and Chair Markort for their work in this area. We also provide a large investment in equalizing the local optional revenue for school districts across the state. And I would like to thank Representative Hewitt and Representative Keeler for their work on this much needed investment. And as I noted, there are a variety of ways we provide property tax cuts across the state as well in a large package of bills. You can see all those bills reflected on the spreadsheet along with the variety of authors who have worked on these very important issues as well. Finally, we make a needed update to the local government aid formula that includes over a 5% increase in funds. Over the years, the LGA program evolved to what we have today and have had for about 35 years, a program to provide state aid to property poor municipalities so that they can provide basic city services. Services like city streets, sewer, clean water, and public safety. This aid is provided by a need-based formula that has also evolved over the years. In fact, about every 10 years, the formula needs adjusting to reflect current market values and the changing needs of our cities. I would like to thank the stakeholders from all their city groups across the state that helped with this needed formula fix. We also provided a slight increase in county program aid in the division report. There are spreadsheets in your packets that show how these increased investments in LGA and CPA and school equalization affect your cities, counties, and school districts. But the numbers, they don't tell the full story. Behind each one of those numbers on the spreadsheet are people. People across the state and all of our communities. You may have heard from some of those folks who just received their property tax statements in the mail or have just seen a really big jump in their rent. They may be young professionals just starting out in the workforce or a family who's trying to make ends meet with rising childcare costs or school loans. They may be someone who's trying to downsize and facing a very crazy housing market, or a senior trying to age in place. The investments we make in this division report is a way to reach people in every corner of the state and provide them with much needed assistance. With that, I will turn this over to nonpartisan staff to walk through the bill. So Mr. Swanson, take it away.
Madam Chair and members, Jared Swanson with House Research. I'm going to start the walkthrough of the division report with Article 1, which is the property tax article. And as Chair Joachim said, there is a House Research bill summary in the member packets and posted online that may be helpful to follow along with as we walk through the division report. So Section 1 of Article 1 is a school equalization provision that sets the first tier local optional revenue equalization factor to 170% of the statewide average tax base per pupil. Section 2 provides a 10-year 50% reduction in net tax capacity for certain property at airports that are owned by cities with a population between 50,000 and 150,000. Section 3 requires that land containing solar energy generating systems be classified as commercial if the property contains more than one system that cannot be combined with another system for the purposes of the solar energy production tax. Section 4 provides a property tax exemption for an elderly living facility in Duluth. Section 5 of Article 1 provides a property tax exemption for energy storage systems. The land on which these systems are located would remain taxable under this provision and would be classified as commercial. Section 6, along with part of Section 9 and all of Section 15 of Article 1, allows certain community land trust property to receive the 4D property tax classification and the reduced classification rate of 0.75%. Section 7, along with part of Section 9 and all of Section 20, create a single classification for manufactured home park property and provide a reduced classification rate of 0.75% for these properties. Section 8 of Article 1 adds industrial hemp to the definition of agricultural products, allowing land on which hemp is grown to be classified as agricultural land for property tax purposes. Section 9 of Article 1 again contains the community land trust and manufactured home provisions I just mentioned. Section 10 changes the disabled veterans exclusion application window for spouses of veterans who died due to a service-connected cause and for spouses of veterans who would have been eligible for the 100% total and permanent disability exclusion. This section would allow applications within 2 years of the service member's death, within 2 years of the spouse receiving a dependency and indemnity compensation determination, or by December 31st, 2023, whichever is later. Any spouse whose application under this provision had previously been denied would be allowed to reapply. And when this bill was originally heard in committee, Representative Detmer suggested a date change for when veteran service officers need to certify information to the county. That date change has been made in this section as well. Section 11 of Article 1 increases the value thresholds and the maximum exclusion amount for the homestead market value exclusion. Section 12 increases the school building bond agricultural credit up to 85%, beginning with property taxes payable in 2024. Sections 13 and 14 remove the 10% minimum on interest rates for both delinquent property taxes and the unpaid balance of any contract to repurchase tax forfeited property. These two sections would also allow counties to set these interest rates lower than the prime rate charged by banks. Section 15 again is related to the community land trust provision I mentioned earlier. Sections 16, 17, 18, and 19 would increase the household income limit for the senior citizens property tax deferral. The limit would increase from $60,000 up to $96,000. These sections would also reduce the minimum number of years the homeowner must occupy the property in order to qualify for the program. This minimum would be reduced from 15 years down to 5. And finally, Section 20 of Article 1 is another conforming change related to the manufactured home provision I mentioned a few moments ago. And Madam Chair, that concludes Article 1, the property tax article. I will stop there and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. I just wanted to, we're going to stop at after every article to see if folks have any questions in the individual articles. So members, are there any questions for Mr. Swanson on Article 1? Seeing none. Oh, Representative Hurtaz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With regard to some of the property tax credits and shifts exclusions that we've got contained in Article 1, do we know exactly where the burden of these levies will remain on the rest of the property tax classifications? And I guess I didn't see any provisions in the division report that there was any business property tax relief. Any comments, Mr. Swanson or Chair Youakim?
Representative Hurtaz, there is not a lot of shifts under other properties in this unless you look at the, even with the senior deferral, that is actually, if I'm understanding, and maybe nonpartisan staff can help me out, the city still gets an aid to cover that until it's paid back, but I might be speaking out of turn. So I will toss it over to Mr. Swanson to maybe answer that, because I'm trying to go back into my foggy memory on how senior deferral works on the payback.
Madam Chair and Representative Hurtaz, there are a couple of provisions in Article 1 that would cause some shifting of property taxes. So one that I'll mention is the changes to the homestead market value exclusion. When this bill was heard in committee, there was a property tax model run that went along with that that showed about $14 million in shifts related to that provision. There are two other provisions, the community land trust piece and the manufactured home park provision, that reduces the classification rate for a couple of different types of property. Again, there would be some shifting involved with both of these provisions. I don't have those numbers in front of me, but I'm happy to take a look at that and get back to the committee with the overall dollar amount of shifts that would be expected under those as well.
Mr. Swanson, remind us on the senior deferral how that works with shifts, and then on the homestead market exclusion, when I looked at the runs you provided when we had the bill up before committee, was it less than a 0.5% on average onto other properties?
Madam Chair, so first with the senior deferral provision, the way that deferral program works is that the state actually makes a portion of the property tax payments on behalf of the individuals who qualify for the program. So there wouldn't be any shifting involved with that provision, as the state is actually making those payments to the local jurisdictions. On the homestead market value exclusion piece, yes, you're correct. I think that it varied a little bit by property type in terms of how much tax was shifted onto those the other types of property. But under the homestead market value exclusion provision, I think it was generally less than 0.5% increase in property taxes related to the shifting for that provision alone. But as I mentioned, there are two other provisions in this article that would cause some shifting. I think it'd be minimal, but I can get those numbers to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Swanson, for clarifying that. I just want to point out to members of the committee that in 10 years, these past 10 years, we've had several discussions and talks about the myriad and complexity of our property tax system with nearly 55 or 56 different classifications. One of the goals has been over these past 10 years, although it's been difficult to initiate any of it, is some compression of these classifications and class rates. I think, and maybe Chair Marquardt might want to chime in, but I think the 4D compression in manufactured homes is probably the first significant consolidation of tax rates or classes that you've seen in nearly 10 years. Doesn't go far enough in terms of simplifying our property tax system. And I don't know about the other members, but I've got a stack of emails that have come in over these last 4 or 5 days as property tax valuations are hitting consumers' mailboxes. I've got a bunch of emails and messages to return about the property tax system and the significant rates of increase in valuations that people are seeing right now, some as high as 63%. And it's not related to a recent sale. So there's going to be some backlash here. And as we go through periods of inflation that seem to be at the threshold of our doorstep, this is reminiscent for those of us old enough to remember, and having been a taxpayer of property in the 70s when there was double-digit inflation, there was quite a controversy over the market values and the assessment values that are going up. And so I suspect members of this committee, if you're not receiving these emails, you'll be getting them soon and probably into the year's future unless we get this inflation under control. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hertas. And thank you for kicking off that compression discussion. I know you and I will be, or and others will be, continuing to work on that next year. And we do have some more property tax relief or cuts coming in the rest of the articles, including the targeted tax credit that is was Representative Hewitt's that we heard as well. Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually was going to wait until Wednesday on some of this stuff because I haven't really had a chance to dig into this. But seeing as how it seemed like he said there was very few shifts, I was wondering if you could explain to me on Article 1, Subdivision 12, the Community Land Trust, because it looks to me like that that we're going to be lowering the property tax. How does this compare with values, I guess? Because the values of these properties are obviously going to go up. And if we're going to hold the property taxes down for the folks that are renting out this land with these houses, someone's going to have to pay that. I mean, because you're going to be raising the value of everybody's property around it, I would assume. Can you walk through that and explain that to me, how that's going to work?
Thank you, Representative Green. Actually, Section 12 is the ag to bond school credit that we're increasing to get farmers a break on their levies for their schools. So it's Section 15, I think you're talking about, with the 4D classification.
Well, actually, this is Section 6, Subdivision 12.
Subdivision 12. Okay.
I think that's what it is. Like I said, I haven't had a chance to mark the bill up the way I should have, but.
Yeah, that's okay, Representative Green. Mr. Swanson, the Community Land Trust provision for the 4D classification, maybe clear up what section that's in and remind me again how many houses does that actually, was very negligible across the entire state.
Madam Chair and Representative Green, the community land trust provisions are actually spread out through three different sections of this article. So Section 6 is one of them, Section 9 is another, and Section 15 of Article 1 is the third piece for this. So basically what these three provisions combined would do is allow community land trust property, as long as it's meeting certain conditions, to qualify for the 4D property tax classification. So instead of being classified as likely a homestead, class 1A with a 1% classification rate, as long as it's under $500,000, these properties would receive this 4D classification and a slightly lower class rate of 0.75%. I'm not sure if the revenue estimate for this bill when it was heard in committee had a total number of properties that could potentially qualify for this change listed, but I believe it did. Perhaps Michelle has the number off of the revenue estimate, but if we don't have that number right now, we can certainly get an estimate on how many properties would qualify for this and get that to the committee.
Michelle.
Madam Chair and members, I'm looking at the revenue estimate right now, which was a little different than what was presented in committee. The revenue estimate contained in the division report does not give a number of properties, but what it does give is about $270 million of market value would change from class 1A residential homestead to the 4D property class. And I'm looking for further information. One thing I do have here is that according to the Minnesota Community Land Trust Coalition, there are 12 community land trust organizations in Minnesota currently, and they have a portfolio of 1,250 homes throughout the state. So that is somewhat of a basis, but we know too, when there are changes that happen, there are some behavioral impacts. We'll get to the revenue estimate or the cost that shows up on the spreadsheet when I go over the spreadsheet. Is that appropriate?
Yes, that's appropriate. Thank you so much, Michelle. I was going to say 1400. I remembered a number floating around in there when the bill was presented, but we didn't want to take a guess at it. So it was actually 1200 properties across the state. Representative Green, does that answer some of your questions?
Kind of, but kind of not, but I can wait. My question really was, has it been calculated in? Because if you're setting up these communities, I know you're talking about the ones that are already there, but this seems to be kind of a growing thing. And when you put in these new housing projects, the values go up, and they go up all over in that area. And so I'm wondering if we're going to be holding these down, is it going to reflect on the existing property owners? You know, we were talking about shifts earlier, and that's what brought that up. So hopefully when we go through the spreadsheet, maybe some of those will be answered.
Thank you, Representative Green. Yes, that creates a small shift. And so, as I said, does the school to ag increase credit because it shifts from the agricultural land onto other properties as well. Representative Hurtaz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Green, I think we got a little bit of a clue there in that the properties that you were mentioning, it was mentioned by Ms. Schill that there was about $275 million of valuation or tax capacity. If that rate is lowered from 1.0 to 0.75, that would lower that to about 206. So there'd be about $69 million of valuation shift to other properties.
Members, any other questions? Seeing none, let's, Representative Hurtaz, you still had your hand up. Did you have another? Oh, there it went down. Got it. Why don't we move on to Article 2?
Madam Chair and members, Article 2 of the Property Tax Division report is the state aids article. So there are 12 sections within this article that are related to the LGA changes that the committee heard in House File 4064. Now, with the exception of the LGA appropriation in Section 9 of this article, all of the LGA sections contained within this article are the same that were in House File 4064. And on the House Research Bill Summary, you'll see sort of a parenthetical marking of LGA for each of the 12 sections that relate to that change. So sections 1 and 2 of this article define two new terms for the LGA formula. Section 3 updates the LGA need formula for all cities. Again, this is the same sort of formula reform that was heard in committee. The new formula factors and the coefficients can be found within the bill summary. Sections 4 and 5 define two new variables for the LGA formula changes that were in section 3. Section 6 is a conforming change related to the LGA provision that references a definition for population age 65 and over that's actually in section 1 of this article. So the definition for this particular variable that's used in the LGA program is also defined in the county program aid portion of Chapter 477A.
Mr. Swanson, excuse me, could, for the benefit of people watching at home as well, could you maybe mention the pages you're on as you're flipping through the sections quickly? You've got 120 some pages of bill here. It would be helpful.
Representative Hurtaz, that might be hard to do. The summary is already on the website as well, so people can see, but Mr. Swanson, do the best you can.
Madam Chair and Representative Hurtaz, sure, I can try to do that. So maybe just a quick recap of where we are. If you're looking at the DE amendment for the actual bill language, Article 2 starts on page 29. And if you're following along with the bill summary, Article 2 starts on page 5.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson.
Yep. So moving on to section 7 and 8, which are on page 7 of the bill summary. These two sections are conforming changes related to the elimination of the certified aid adjustments within the LGA reform. Section 9, as I mentioned, is the one provision that was in House File 4064 that is different within the division report language. And what House File 4064 did was increase the LGA appropriation by 5%. That increase was increased by an additional $6 million under the division report. So this brings the overall LGA appropriation increase to just over $34 million annually. And again, that's on page 7 of the House Research Bill Summary and on page 33 of the DE amendment. Section 10 increases the county program aid appropriation by $13 million annually. Section 11 of Article 2 establishes a new state aid program that would distribute $22 million annually to soil and water conservation districts. Section 12, which is on page 8 of the summary, is another conforming change related to the LGA provision. This is related to the elimination of certified aid adjustments. Section 13 of Article 2 establishes the Stronger Community Aid Program. This replaces the current local performance measurement program for counties and cities. This bill was heard in committee, and there is one difference between this section and the bill as it was heard in committee, and that has to do with the payment structure for this aid. So the change in the division report is that this section keeps the same payment amounts that are currently in statute for the local performance measurement program. And the Stronger Community Aid provision is on page 37 of the Delete Everything Amendment, and still on page 8 of the summary. Section 14 is another conforming change related to the LGA changes that eliminate the certified aid adjustments. Sections 15 and 16 of Article 2 provide aid penalty forgiveness for the cities of Echo and Morton. Section 17, which is now moving on to page 9 of the summary. Section 17 repeals definitions of some LGA formula factors that would no longer be used. It also repeals the definitions of sparsity adjustments and certified aid adjustments. And finally, Section 18 of Article 2 repeals the local performance measurement program that's currently in statute for counties and cities. Again, the Stronger Community Aid Program that's in Section 13 is meant to replace this section. And Madam Chair, that concludes Article 2.
Members, do we have any questions on Article 2? Give folks a second. Seeing none, we'll move on to Article 3.
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Article 3 relates to tax increment financing, or TIF. Sections 1 through 11 make technical and policy changes to general law governing TIF, and the remaining sections provide special TIF authority to the cities of Fridley, Hopkins, Plymouth, Savage, and Woodbury. Section 1 of the bill, which is on page 41, expands the definition of administrative expenses to list expenses which qualify as administrative for the purposes of TIF. Section 2, which is on page 42, defines a pay-as-you-go contract and note for the purposes of TIF. Section 3, also on page 42, clarifies whether certain payments to county auditors count towards the total increment generated by a TIF district, and it exempts certain administrative expenditures from counting towards the cap on administrative expenditures. Section 4, which is on page 43, adds the payment of administrative expenses to the list of purposes for which TIF revenue can be used. Section 5, which is on page 44, clarifies which payments to county auditors count towards the total increment generated by a TIF district for the purposes of pooling limits. Section 6 makes technical changes to the 5-year rule and removes an obsolete exception for public infrastructure projects. Section 7, which is on page 47, provides rules for decertification of a district and for deferral of decertification for a district with an outstanding pay-as-you-go note. Section 8, which is on page 51, corrects a formula for calculating the deficit of a district. Section 9, which is on page 53, removes an exception for failure to certify a district from a requirement that an authority pay to the county auditor the amount generated from a property which was unlawfully included or kept in a TIF district. Section 10, which begins on page 53, makes a clarifying change regarding a county auditor's withholding increments from authorities that fail to comply with their annual requirements for disclosure and financial reporting. And section 11, which begins on page 55, expands the sources of permitted purposes of TIF expenditures from Minnesota Statute Section 469.176 to Minnesota Statute Sections 469.174 through 469.1794. Section 12, which begins on page 55, amends special rules governing Hopkins TIF District number 2-11 by removing a 20% cap on expenditures for housing and blight correction outside the district, and by increasing the total cap on out-of-district expenditures from 25 to 30%. Section 13, which begins on page 56, amends special rules for TIF districts in the city of Savage, which were created pursuant to 2004 special legislation. Section 13 further extends the five-year rule applying to those districts from 8 years to 11 years, and it extends the time period during which those districts can be enlarged from 5 years to 8 years after decertification or after certification. Section 14, which begins on page 57, establishes special rules for Fridley TIF District number 20, which would allow the district to transfer the percentage of its increment, which is allowed to be spent outside of the district, to the Fridley Housing and Redevelopment Authority for those for that increment to be spent on housing programs. Section 15, which begins on page 58, authorized Plymouth to create a TIF district governed by special rules that would extend the five-year rule to 10 years, that would exempt the district from requirements to spend increment on blight correction, and that would allow increment to be spent on County Road 47 while having those expenditures count as activity within the district. Section 16, which begins on page 59, authorizes Woodbury both to extend the time during which it receives increment from TIF District number 13 by 5 years, and it authorizes Woodbury to spend increment from the district on improvements to Central Park. And with that, I'll hold for questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Cope. And members, just as a reminder, Articles 1 through 11 in this, or sorry, Sections 1 through 11 in this article, in Article 3, are part of House File 4281, and that was the Office of the State Auditor's suggestions to tighten up and clean up the TIF statutes in language, and it was worked on with the cities and folks that implement TIF too. So it's a good transparency and tightening up of statute items. So with that, members, do we have any questions on the TIF section? Seeing none, we'll go on to Article 4.
Madam Chair and members, Article 4 is the local taxes article. This article includes provisions that modify the general local sales tax law, includes a number of special local sales tax authorizations for the legislature from the legislature for various local cities, and also includes provisions for local lodging taxes. So this is going to be on page 13 of the bill summary, and the local taxes article starts on page 59 of the underlying DE amendment. Sections 1 through 3, this is House File 3381 with a modification. These three sections amend the general local sales tax law. Section 1 adds clarifying language regarding prohibition on local government spending funds to support a referendum. Section 2 does a few things. First, it would require a resolution for modifications to an existing tax, resolution from the local government. It would also require that when a local government is seeking legislative authority to impose a local sales tax, that they would have to submit a new resolution if the proposal changes. It would also require that the resolution would also have to make a finding of nexus between the non-resident payers of the tax and the non-resident users of the project. And then on page 62 of the DE, there are five nexus requirements that are included in that language. And a local government would have to find that two out of the five of them are met. And so that briefly, it's the five requirements would be a significant number of the users of the project will be non-residents. The project includes a unique or uncommon characteristic. The project is part of a larger network of providing facilities or services. The project promotes an activity that has a duration long enough to keep people around to use the local retail base. And then the last requirement for Nexus would be whether the design of the project includes improvements that would increase the capacity beyond what would be expected for a population of the size where the project is going to be done. Section 3 of the bill, this would be on page 14 of the bill summary, and we'd be on page 62 and 63 of the underlying DE. This would require legislative approval to modify a local sales tax, and also adds clarifying language about when the resolution or when the local tax can be voted on by the voters in the local government. And that's clarified as the first Monday and the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. Moving on then to some of the specific local sales taxes. This is section 4 of the bill, page 63. Sections 4 through 7 are all related to the Rochester local sales tax. And this is on page 63 to 67 of the bill. This would allow Rochester to extend its current 0.50% local sales tax for a period of 16.5 years. They could spend the revenues on three projects: street reconstruction, flood control, a regional community center. If those projects are paid off and fully funded, then the city would be allowed to use additional sales tax revenues that come in prior to the termination date to fund additional project costs for those three specifically listed projects. Moving on to section 8, this is on page 67 of the bill and page 15 of the bill summary. This is the Cook County lodging tax proposal that would allow the county to increase the duration of its local lodging tax from 15 years to 30 years, and would also strike existing language authorizing the city to impose a tax on admissions and recreation. Section 9 is the City of Marshall's local sales tax authorization. This is on page 68 to 70 of the underlying bill. This would allow the City of Marshall to impose a 0.50% local sales tax to fund $16 million for the construction of a new aquatic center. And the tax would terminate at the earlier of 30 years or when the City Council determines that it should be terminated if they've raised sufficient funds. And for all the taxes, I'll also mention a general comment for the local sales taxes. All of them allow the City Council to terminate that tax at an earlier date if they determine that they've raised sufficient revenues to pay for the projects and the bonds. In addition, for all these projects, the local sales tax authorization also allows the city to bond for those projects in the amount of the cost of the projects that are also listed in the bill, unless otherwise specified. So I won't mention that for the rest of the taxes, but that's a general rule for all of these local taxes. Section 10 on page 70 to 71 of the underlying DE is a City of Plymouth local lodging tax provision. This removes the expiration date for the local lodging tax that was authorized by the legislature in 2019. Page 71 to 73 of the bill, that's section 11, that's the local sales tax for the City of Edina. This section would allow the city to increase the amount of sales tax revenue that it can allocate to the Bramer Park project. The local sales tax for Edina for this project and one other park project was authorized by the legislature in 2021, and this provision would allow them to increase the amount allocated to that project from $21.6 million to $46.9 million. As for Rochester, the city of Edina would also be able to use any proceeds generated from the tax prior to the expiration date if the two park projects have been paid off to fund capital improvement projects for the city's park and recreation system. And the duration of the Edina local sales tax was reduced from 19 years to 17 years as well. 19 years is what the city was authorized for in the bill that was enacted last year. Moving on to page 16 of the bill summary, page 73 to 74 of the underlying bill. Section 12 is the City of Grand Rapids local sales tax. This allows them to increase the duration of the tax from 7 years to 10 years and increase the amount of local sales tax revenue that the city can collect for its Civic Center project. Pages 74 and 75 of the bill is the City of Aiken's local sales tax authorization. This would allow the city to impose a 1% local sales tax to fund two projects in the city, a new municipal building and for a park and trail project. And the duration of this tax would be 19 years. Section 14 on page 76 of the bill is the City of Black Duck's local sales tax authorization. This authorizes the city to impose a 0.5% local sales tax to fund five projects in the city for a city campground, walking trail, wayside rest, irrigation equipment for a golf course, and for the reconstruction of a library. And the termination on that tax would be 20 years after it's first imposed. Page 17 of the bill summary, and then moving to page 77 of the bill. This is the City of Bloomington's local sales tax authorization. This would allow the city to impose a tax of 0.5% to fund three projects in the city for the Bloomington Ice Garden, a community wellness and health center, and also for the Bloomington Center for the Arts. There's some clarifying language about the associated infrastructure that can for which the local sales tax can be used to fund. That's also in the word associated infrastructure is also in the general local sales tax law, and there's some further definition that this particular section provides for that. And the termination of the Bloomington tax would be 20 years. Moving on to page 18 of the bill summary, page 79 of the bill would be the section 16, which is the Brooklyn Center local sales tax. This authorizes the city to impose a 0.5% sales tax to fund renovations and expansions for the Brooklyn Center Community Center. That tax would expire in 20 years after imposed. Page 80 of the underlying bill is 80 to 82 is the City of East Grand Forks local sales tax. The section would allow East Grand Forks to impose a sales tax of 1.25% to fund two projects in the city for the Civic Center and for an arena. And $16.5 million would be allocated to the Civic Center and $5 million to the arena project. That's a slight difference from how the bill was heard in committee. And that tax would terminate in 20 years. Moving on to page 19 of the bill summary, pages 82 to 83 of the bill, is section 18 is the City of Golden Valley's local sales tax. It would authorize the city to impose a tax of 0.50% to fund two projects in the city for a public works and a public safety facility. And that project would terminate in 30 years. Section 19 on page 83 to 85 of the bill is the City of Henderson's local sales tax. The bill would allow them to impose a tax of 0.5% to fund a campground improvement project and trail project in the city. And that tax would terminate in 15 years. Section 20 is the local sales tax for the City of Proctor. This is on page 85 to 86 of the bill. It allows the city to impose a tax of 0.5% to fund construction of a new regional trail in the city. And the termination of that tax would be 20 years after imposed. Section 21, this is now page 20 of the bill summary, and page 86 to 87 of the bill. This is the Rice County sales tax. This would authorize the county to impose a 0.375% sales tax to fund a new public safety facility. And the duration of that tax would be 30 years. Section 22 is the City of Roseville's local sales tax proposal. That's on page 87, 88 of the bill. That allows the city to impose a local sales tax of 0.50% to fund three projects in the city, a maintenance facility, license and passport center, and a pedestrian bridge. And that tax would terminate in 16 years. Moving on to page 21 of the bill summary, page 89 to 90 of the bill. Section 23 is the Winona County sales tax. This section would authorize the county to impose a sales tax of 0.25% to fund construction and upgrades to a correctional facility. And that tax would terminate in 25 years. Lastly, then on page 90 of the bill is the provision for the City of Woodbury's local lodging tax. And this bill would just allow the city to dedicate 2/3 of the revenue that it collects from the tax for capital improvements to public recreational facilities. And one difference from that provision from the bill that was heard in the committee is that the bill heard in committee allowed the city to impose local lodging taxes at a combined rate of up to 6%. And this provision in section 24 does not allow that 6% cap. And so it would be capped at the statutory maximum of 3%. And Madam Chair and members, that concludes Article 4. And I'll pause here in case there are questions on the local taxes article.
Members, are there any questions in Article 4? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Klayman. We'll move on to Article 5.
Chair Joachim and members, Sean Williams from House Research. I'm going to discuss Article 5. This is the article pertaining to the renter's credit. Rather than go through section by section, there's a lot of individual sections in this article that are fairly technical in nature, updating cross-references and striking language from the property tax refund section of statute. So I'm going to talk sort of more at a high level about the policy change in here, and I'm happy to address specific pieces of language if members are interested. So Article 5 would convert the renter's credit into a refundable income tax credit. It would be effective for 2022 refunds. Those are refunds based on 2022 incomes, 2022 rents, and payable in 2023. And by the way, I'm on page 21 of the bill summary. And if members are interested in seeing the new language in the bill text, the language sort of for the new income tax credit is available on page 93, line 7 of the bill text. The credit would be calculated in the same manner as under current law, although the bill would use adjusted gross income rather than the broader definition of household income that is used under current law to calculate renter's credits. The bill would retain the exemptions for taxpayers with dependents, taxpayers who are older than 60 or 65 and older, and taxpayers that have a disability. So as a result of this change, renters would claim the credit on their income tax return, which is generally due April 15th. And so under current law, refunds are generally paid out in August or September. So this is sort of move the payment of refunds over to earlier in the year. The bill largely retains all of the administrative provisions in Chapter 290A, which is the renter's credit chapter. In some cases, that language has been duplicated in the new section under Chapter 290 for the income tax credit if it's needed. In other cases, it's incorporated by cross-reference in Section 290. And then there is one case where we're moving over a section from Chapter 290A, the property tax refund chapter, as a subdivision of of Section 290.0693, which is the new section for the renter's income tax credit. And so there's a revisor's instruction included that instructs the revisor to sort of recodify that one section. And it was sort of the only one we found working with the revisor that was kind of a standalone section that would make sense to just move over through a recodification. If you look in, on your summary on page 22, there's sort of a table included that describes each sort of chunk of language that's in the new section of law that's being coded in chapter 290 for the renter's credit, and then sort of an indication of where that language originated from. Hopefully there's nothing in there that's new. It should be all just kind of moving over administrative language and other language that exists in current law in chapter 290A. So that's a brief kind of high level overview of the renter's credit. I'll pause for questions here in case members are curious.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Members, are there any questions, detailed questions for Mr. Williams on this section? Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have any questions. I guess I just want to highlight, you know, what a big deal this change to the renter's credit is, and to thank you, Madam Chair, for you know, choosing to do something really bold in this time. You know, this will add more than 100,000 new renters will be claiming the renter's credit with this switch to adding it to a line on the income tax. You know, as when you get the renter's credit, like, you receive a certificate of rent paid from your landlord, and then you have to file paperwork along with that certificate separate from your income taxes. And we just have a pretty low, I mean, it's not a low uptake rate, but there are hundreds of thousands of renters across the state of Minnesota who leave money on the table. And, you know, this, the renter's credit is sort of our, like, our circuit breaker for property taxes that renters pay. And so it really is a way for us to introduce progressivity into our property tax refund, or I mean into our property taxes, right? Because there's no income sensitivity on the front end of property taxes. And so as a state, we decide that we want you know, to make sure that housing, whether it's rental housing or whether you own your home, to be affordable to people based on their income. And so, you know, this is going to be a game changer. This is going to mean that, you know, a lot of people who weren't getting this refund before will get it. It's going to align with our shared values of tax simplicity and tax fairness. And so I'm really excited about this provision. You know, I'm excited for all those people who are working hard out in our communities and are going to be able to kind of more easily access, you know, the property tax refund that they are entitled to. So thank you so much, Madam Chair, for including this provision. And thank you to Chair Marquardt for all his work on this issue and on, you know, again, on these, you know, I remember the very first time that I heard Representative Marquardt talk about taxes, that's what he talked about. He talked about fairness and about simplicity. And so this just aligns perfectly with that. And you know, I think that everybody who works in the area of taxes shares those values, because we know that's what our people need from our tax system. And so again, just my gratitude to everybody who's worked on this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Gomez. Let's move on to Article 6.
Chair Youakim and members, Article 6 is the miscellaneous article. It's really kind of two categories of provisions. There's some provisions related to the homestead credit refund and the other property tax refund, the targeting program. And then there's a provision related to tourism improvement districts. So I'll be working on page 108 of the bill text and page 24 at the top of the summary. So section one is the section related to the homestead credit state refund, or the homeowner's property tax refund program. The bill would increase the maximum refunds for all income ranges that currently receive the credit by $200. It reduces the threshold percentages by 0.1% for income household or claimants that have household income between $21,410 and $33,120. And lastly, it reduces the copay percentages by 5% for claimants with household incomes between $33,120 and $77,870. This is effective for 2022 refunds. So they're based on 2022 incomes payable in 2023. And there's actually an error in the bill summary. It'd be for 2023 property taxes, not 2022 property taxes. Section 2 of the bill is the additional property tax refund. This is also known as the targeting provision. That's the refund program for households that experience large one-year increases year over year in their property taxes. So under current law, your property taxes have to go up by more than 12% to qualify for this refund. And the maximum refund is $1,000. So Section 2 of this bill would reduce that threshold from 12% to 10% and then increase the maximum refund from $1,000 to $2,000. This is also effective for 2022 refunds, which are payable next year based on 2023 property taxes. So they'd be for individuals that have high 2023 property taxes relative to 2022. Section 3 of the bill is just updating the inflation adjustment language to account for the change in Section 1 to the Homestead Credit State refund. And my colleague, Mr. Cope, will be following up for the rest of this article.
Madam Chair and members, sections 4 through 13 constitute the last sections of this article and the last sections of this bill. Those sections create a new chapter in Minnesota statutes, which would authorize municipalities to establish tourism improvement districts, or TIDs. Section 4, which begins on page 111 of the division report, defines terms for the purposes of the new chapter, including defining a business as a lodging business, as that term is defined by municipal law, defining impacted business owners as a majority of business owners in the TID, and defining a tourism improvement association as an entity contracted with the municipality to administer the TID and to implement activities and improvements to promote tourism in the district. Section 5, which begins on page 112, allows a municipality to adopt an ordinance establishing a TID after receiving a petition from impacted business owners. It also allows for appeal of the establishment of the TID. Section 6, which begins on page 114, allows a municipality to impose a service charge to finance activities or improvements to benefit businesses in the TID and requires an annual hearing on continuation of the service charge. Section 7 allows a municipality to modify a TID after receiving either a request from a tourism improvement association or a petition from impacted business owners and then holding a public hearing. Section 7 also allows business owners to veto any proposed change. Section 8 allows the establishing municipality, the Tourism Improvement Association, or another designated entity to collect the TID service charge and to charge penalties and interest for delinquent payments. Section 9 requires an ordinance establishing a TID to designate a Tourism Improvement Association and requires the association to have a governing board or committee composed of a majority of business owners paying the service charge or their representatives. The Tourism Improvement Association is required to report annually on the revenue raised by the district. Section 10 requires a petition of impacted business owners for a municipality to either establish or modify a TID. Section 11 requires any ordinance adopted under this chapter to take effect at least 45 days after enacted, and it allows a majority of business owners in a proposed or established TID to veto any ordinance by filing objections with the clerk of the municipality. Section 12 requires an annual 30-day period in which impacted business owners may petition for a disestablishment of a tourism improvement district, and after decertification, it requires a refund of any remaining revenues directly or indirectly derived from the service charge. Section 13 prohibits a county from establishing a TID in the area where a city or town established a TID, and it prohibits a city or town from establishing a TID in the area where a county established a TID. And with that, I will hold for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Cope. Members, are there any questions on the miscellaneous chapter? The Tourism Improvement District is the bill we heard last year that was in our division report as it moved forward, didn't quite make the final negotiations. Seeing no questions, I think we'll go to Ms. Schill so she can walk through the spreadsheet. Ms. Schill. Ms. Schiller, are you ready to walk through the spreadsheet? Do we have Ms. Templin on? Well, maybe Ms. Schill's had to step away for a minute. Why don't we go ahead and go through a few of our testifiers, and then we'll bounce back to Ms. Schill for, oh, Ms. Templin, I see you coming on my screen. Oh, you're on mute. Ms. Templin, you're on mute. There we go.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will go check on Ms. Schill. She's been having technical issues, and I will let the committee know her status, and hopefully she'll be right back on.
Thank you, Ms. Templin. For because we are on a tighter schedule, I will move to testifiers then. So first up on the list, we have the Department of Revenue, and we have Assistant Commissioner John Klaxine here with us. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
All right. Thank you, Chair Joaquin, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is John Klaxine. I'm an Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. First, I'd like to commend the Chair for including expansions to the Homestead Property Tax Refund. These refunds target low-income households and those on fixed incomes, and are an important program for helping reduce the cost of housing and shore up taxpayers' ability to meet basic needs. This bill takes a new approach to the renter's credit by converting it to an income tax credit instead of a current standalone program. We will continue to work with the authors to make sure this credit can be administered. The governor proposed expanding the homestead credit to taxpayers with ITINs, and we hope to continue this conversation as the bill moves forward. I want to thank you for including the Governor Walz's Soil and Water Conservation District aid in this bill. This aid will ensure SWCDs have a reliable funding source to continue protecting Minnesota's natural resources. Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan value the state's relationship with local governments, and increasing local government aid and county program aid will help communities provide public safety services to residents. Although the governor's proposed budget took a different approach to achieve those goals, there are many ways to support our local government partners, and we look forward to continuing this discussion. Additionally, we want to thank the chair for including several smaller provisions from the governor's tax bill, including increasing the income limit for senior citizens' property tax deferral program and adding hemp to the definition of agricultural product for property tax purposes. While these are smaller provisions, they still help many taxpayers, and we appreciate the chair including these provisions. There are a couple of new property tax exclusions, exemptions, and classification changes that we will continue to review to make sure they are administrable as intended. In the upcoming weeks, we look forward to working with the tax committees to ensure a fair and equitable tax bill for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Klaxine. With that, I'm going to go back over to Ms. Schill for the spreadsheet and then back to the testifiers.
Madam Chair, members, Kathy Schill from House Fiscal. My computer totally froze up, and so I apologize for this delayed response. I'm in Ms. Templin's office right now, but I can give you a presentation of the spreadsheet. So please bear with me as I've literally picked up and moved myself to be able to accommodate this testimony. And I'm not sure where her camera is, so please bear with me if I'm not looking at you directly. It's not intended to be that way.
Two of us with a computer locked up.
You know, it's always a test, and you know, as long as you keep your cool, you're doing great. Members and others, to go over the spreadsheet today, we're taking a look at House File 4064 with an amendment that originally was posted as a DE, meaning to delete all amendment, but that was modified to the A22-0389 amendment. I will tell you that the posting originally under the DE1 and this particular spreadsheet, all the numbers are the same. So no panicking at all if you printed out the spreadsheet at an earlier time. It's only the label that has changed. Okay, and as we go through the spreadsheet, remember that positive numbers are program expenditures. We're talking spending here. Negative numbers are a cost savings. This spreadsheet, as we look at the top three lines, you will see that there are property tax aids and credits. There is a line for the February 22 forecast. Total spending in the forecast is $4.153 billion in 2022-23 and $4.342 billion in 24-25. Line two shows the changes that are summed up in the spreadsheet and reflected in a total under fiscal 22-23 of $394,600,000. For 24-25, total spending is $612,260,000. Now, if you add those together, I just saw a glitch once again in the spreadsheet. The total, when you add those two together, should be on line three, $4,548,239,000. And then for 24-25, it should be $4,955,063,000. Now let's begin down the spreadsheet. It's divided basically into two components. First are the property tax refunds, and those are reflected through lines 5 through 30, and then lines 31 and beyond are tax aids and credits. So beginning with line 6, we're looking at Representative Joachim's changes to the homestead credit state refund. That's the homeowner's property tax refund. This is different than what was presented in committee. The parameters have changed, as Mr. Williams has outlined. A maximum refund of $200, reduced thresholds by 0.1% for certain income ranges, and reduced copays of 5% at certain income ranges. The total impact of that is in the tails only at $72 million. Moving down the spreadsheet between lines 8 and 11 are changes to the renter's credit. This is the conversion of the existing renter's property tax refund to an income tax credit. There are two lines reflected here. First is the repeal of the existing renter's credit program. The sunset date is for rent paid in 22-23 taxes filed, 2022 taxes filed in 2023. That repeal provision affects only the tails for a total of $466,300,000. Now, the new renter's income tax credit, effective once again for rent paid 2022 taxes filed in 2023, we've got an overlap going on here. And so that new program kicks in 2023 at $372,600,000. And then it carries forward into 24 and 25 for a total of $764,300,000. Now, when you add those two together, you'll see the total impact in 22-23, as I said, $372.6 million. And then the two, the impact in 24-25 is $298 million. Moving down the spreadsheet, line 12 is a special targeting property tax refund, as Mr. Williams mentioned. Two parameters are changing there. The total impact in 24-25 is $3.9 million. And then we go into other property tax changes. Representative Hertas, manufactured home classification, park classification, $270,000 in fiscal 25. House file 3629, Representative Morris bill on the homestead market value exclusion. Those changes are a negative, it's a cost savings of $1.61 million in 25. Representative Detmer's bill shared with Representative Lisligard, the disabled veterans home said market value exclusion, and that's the application deadline for spouses. There is a negligible cost savings in each year of the tails. Negligible means the impact is less than $5,000 per year. Moving down the spreadsheet further to Representative Richardson's Community Land Trust property classification, that rate at 0.75%. There's a property tax refund interaction of $180,000, and that's a cost savings in each of the years in the tails. Line 23 is House File 3384, Representative Hansen, Senior Citizens Property Tax Deferral Program. There is a cost there of $930,000 in the tails. And I recall a question earlier in today's meeting about what we currently spend on that program. This is one that is reflected through a separate line in the fund balance. It's called net loan activity. We have for the 22-23 biennium right now, currently we pay out about $1.8 million per year. And the loans that loan payments that we receive are slightly less than that. So the balance is about $459,000 per year. So this impact in the tails would be added to that. Moving down the spreadsheet on line 25, we have Representative Schultz, elderly living facilities exempted from taxation that had an impact of $10,000 in fiscal 25. Line 26 is House File 3782. This is Representative Stevenson's bill on energy storage systems, the exemption for that. This is a little different than what you saw in committee. The refund provision that was retroactive was not included here. So the cost impact that you see is only in the tails at $20,000 per year. Line 27 is House File 2181. This is Representative Anderson's solar generating system. This is a clarification of property tax there that has a negative negligible impact in each of the years. House File 3678, Representative Schultz's provision for airport property. This is a modified version of the revenue estimate we saw in committee. And the Department of Revenue submitted a revised revenue estimate. I think it was right after we heard this bill. And the cost has increased slightly. It was, I think, $10,000 per year, and now it is $20,000 each year in the tails. Moving on to the aids and credits section of the spreadsheet, lines 32 through 37 here are the changes to the LGA formula bill and also the Minoman property tax reimbursement aid. The first line, you'll see the $34.22 million per year in each year of the tails for the appropriation increase. You'll see the revision. This is not changing Minoman's property tax amount going to the city. It is changing it to a reimbursement aid, and the other provision that it was operating under is in session law, and that is being repealed. So this is nothing new, but because that provision is being repealed, I need to show it on the spreadsheet. And then we have both property tax interactions and income tax interactions. So the bottom line for these changes is $66.26 million in as a total FY24-25 impact. Continuing on, lines 38 and 39 are each of the LGA penalty forgiveness. for the city of Echo and for the city of Morton. The language written is that as long as the city complies with filing prior, I think it's by June 1st, the payment must go out before the end of the fiscal year. So the impact is zero. That money is already appropriated. So it shows up as zero on the spreadsheet. Lines 41 through 45 are the county program aid increases and associated interactions. As Mr. Swanson said, it's an increase of $13 million per year. And then with the both property tax refund interactions and income tax interactions, that turns out to be $12.5 million per year for a total of $25.06 for the FY24-25 biennium. Lines 46 through 49 are House File 2928. This is Representative Marquardt's new Stronger Community Aid Program created. This is different, as Mr. Swanson mentioned, than what you saw in committee. There is a repeal of the performance aid, but then the same calculation for the aid will carry into the new Stronger Community Aid Program. And so those two net each other out. And that's what you see on line 49 with a zero cost impact. Moving on to page two, we have lines 50 through 53 are the SWCD aid, which is Soil and Water Conservation District aid. This is brand new. It is exactly what you saw in committee. So there is an appropriation each year, fiscal 23, 24, and 25 of $22 million per year. Lines 54 through 58 are the school district equalization aid provisions. Now, this is a concentration on the local option revenue levy. Definitely different than what you saw in committee, but has been worked through. The levy impact itself, and this includes the 90-10 payment schedule that we provide for school aid, that total equals $90,690,000 in fiscal 24-25. And then you see the interactions associated with that level of payment. And so the total cost ends up being $81.75 million in 24 and 25. Lines 59 through 63 are Representative Vang's bill for the expansion of the definition of agricultural land to include hemp. That cost is $70,000 per beginning in fiscal 25. And the last item under aids and credits is Representative Marquardt's increase in school building bond agricultural credit to 85%. You'll see the impact there is $21.9 million beginning in 25. And so the total changes, once again, for fiscal 22-23, $394,600,000. And in 24-25, $612,260,000. Now there is another page and a half entirely of the spreadsheet with zero costs. And what that includes is Representative Hertas's delinquent property tax interest rate bill, Representative Dabney's tourism improvement districts, and then six, as reviewed by Mr. Cope, six different TIF bills, including the auditor bill, three local lodging, food and beverage tax bills, as Mr. Klayman pointed out, and once again, 16 different bills for local option sales taxes. And Madam Chair, that concludes the presentation of the spreadsheet, and I appreciate your indulgence for this last minute shift.
Thank you so much, Michelle. I know things like that can you did not get thrown off at all, and I greatly appreciate it. Members, we added a little more time to committee just so we can get through the testifiers and have time for brief closing comments. We'll have more discussion on Wednesday, but does anybody have any quick questions for Ms. Schill on the spreadsheet? And I'm sure she'd be happy to answer some of them offline as well. With that, members, we are going to go over to the rest of the testifiers, and we have Garrett Carlson from the League of Minnesota Cities. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for the opportunity to testify today on House File 4064 as amended. My name is Gary Carlson. I work with the League of Minnesota Cities, representing 837 member cities across the state. I'd like to just first briefly thank the Chair Joachim and Lead Hertas and all the members of the committee for all the testimony you've allowed or considered from me over the year. Also, I just want to give a special thank you to Ms. Cirkvenik and Mr. Peterson for their exceptional work in running this committee and keeping all of us informed about the activities. To the bill specifically, we have submitted a letter in support of the local government aid formula changes and updates and the appropriation increase, so I won't spend much time on that, but I just want to reiterate we do support and appreciate having that included in the bill. We also support the policy and technical TIF changes that are contained in Article 3 of the bill. I want to thank the Office of the State Auditor for facilitating discussions with cities, counties, school districts, and TIF experts earlier this year to address some of the technical but important ambiguities that exist in Chapter 469. I want to thank the Chair for considering our input into the local sales tax process changes in Article 4, Sections 1 through 3. And we don't have specific positions on the local sales taxes, but again, I appreciate working with the Chair and Ms. Cirkvenik to really make those hearings run as smoothly as possible and the interactions with the city officials involved. And then finally, Madam Chair, I'd like to point out that League policies do generally support the homestead credit refund, the renters refund program, and the targeting programs that are contained in Articles 5 and 6. Although local government aid is a key program for assuring cities across the state can adequately provide services to residents, these programs clearly assure that tax burdens defined by the classification system, by changes in annual market valuations of properties, and city and county tax levy decisions don't overly burden individuals. And most importantly, these programs provide targeted relief without shifting taxes to other types of property. Madam Chair, I'll stay on the line and in the room if there's any questions at all, but thank you again for including these provisions in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Next up is Bradley Peterson from the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, my name is Bradley Peterson, representing the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. Having participated in the LGA work group with the other city organizations and being fully supportive of the formula updates, I'd like to thank you, Chair Joachim, for the inclusion of the LGA formula updates in the division report. We also note the appropriation increase contained in the division report. Even with this increase in the program, needs continue to be great as cities come out of the upheaval of the pandemic. As we look at the funding level for LGA, we can't help but compare it to the funding level for the Homestead Credit Refund Program. Because that program is already adjusted by inflation, its growth has been disproportionate to the LGA program, which, as we know, does not see an annual inflation adjustment. If the division report becomes law, since 2013, by our analysis, when significant changes were made to both programs, there will be a 136% increase in the homestead credit refund compared to a projected 55% increase in the state's general fund, and only a 40% increase in the LGA appropriation. The Homestead Credit Refund, which is already on autopilot and already on an aggressive upward trajectory, from our point of view, does not warrant the additional rocket boost provided for in the division report, especially when LGA continues to lag behind. As the bill continues to make its way through the legislative process, we look forward to working with you, Chair Joachim, and all the other members of the committee to make the LGA formula updates a reality and to find additional funding for the LGA program. Thank you very much for the opportunity today.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Next up, we have Patricia Nauman from Metro Cities. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, representing cities throughout the 7-county metropolitan area at the state legislature. Just want to thank you to Chair Joachim for sponsoring the local government aid bill and for the inclusion of the updates to the formula factors in the amendment to House File 4064, the Property Tax Division Report. The LGA provisions do recognize that the needs of cities do evolve, and thus the statistical validity of factors that can adequately predict city needs also changes over time. So very much appreciate the inclusion of these updated factors in the bill today before you. The updates in the report will help to ensure that the LGA formula can adequately anticipate variances in city needs and spending going forward. I just want to say too that the ability of the program factors to do this, even as factors can seem obscure and hard to explain, are what underpin the formula's strength and credibility over time. Metro Cities does further appreciate and support increase to the LGA distribution and appreciates the $28 million increase in the delete all amendment today in the Property Tax Division report. The association does continue to support a higher level of appropriation, as was discussed in the division previously, and that was introduced in House File 3794 that was heard a couple of weeks ago. So we will continue to look forward to working with you, Madam Chair and members, on the appropriation level going forward. Just a couple of other provisions. I want to note that Metro Cities does support, as Mr. Carlson had mentioned, the tax increment financing provisions that are included in Article 3. These will help to create more clarity in the statutory language governing the provisions for tax increment financing. And I do also want to say a thank you to the auditor and her staff for facilitating these discussions with stakeholders. They can be very painstaking, but they're very important. And finally, generally speaking, Metro Cities also does support the direct property tax relief programs, both for homeowners and renters, and supports modifications to expand programs, as well as any changes that ensure that these programs are effective, equitable, and user-friendly. Finally, Madam Chair, just generally thank you, to your division, to your members, and to your staff, and to nonpartisan staff for your work with us this year. We look forward to continuing to work with you as the session proceeds. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. Matt Hilgart's next, Association of Metropolitan Minnesota Counties. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Matt Hilgart. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC represents all of Minnesota's 87 counties. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the inclusion of several provisions, including Representative Anderson's bill to create some uniformity on solar energy systems. This is Article 1, Section 3. The changes to the Senior Property Tax Deferral Program has been a recent addition to the AMC platform. We were glad to see that in there as well. Allowing counties to set their own tax delinquency rates lower than the current rates afforded in statute, thanks to legal aid for making us aware of this issue, and we appreciate your inclusion of this. The SWCD aid category, I want to be clear, this is not a pass-through aid to counties. This doesn't go to our bottom lines, but it goes to our partners who are doing great work locally, and we support this. So thank you, Chair Mark Ward, for your support of this and getting this in the bill. And then also just generally, Madam Chair, your thoughtfulness on approaching property tax relief through several mechanisms, including local government aid and CPA. My county assessors and AMC are increasingly making me aware of property tax valuation increases that could see folks having $100 or more property tax increase on their bills without any increase in budgets or levies. And so that's what we are facing. And so I appreciate that the alarm has been sounded and that folks are looking at this. It's no surprise to you, Madam Chair, that we are concerned about the lack of parity between the CPA and LGA programs. CPA county program aid is less than half the current LGA formula. And I think we had made some good turnarounds in recent years to make sure that these programs are funded equitably at 1-to-1 ratio. And we're a little bit concerned that the CPA as a percentage of county levy is less than half of what cities get. And so I think these both programs are very warranted programs. We absolutely support LGA as well as CPA, but we are hopeful that we can work in future weeks and months ahead on some parity on these increases. Once again, thanks for including us on all these conversations.
Thank you, Mr. Hilgart. I'm going to switch around order to get some folks in, but The folks that don't testify today will move you to Wednesday. So don't worry, we're not going to add any more new testifiers, but we'll move those who had already signed up to Wednesday if we run out of time. So I would like to move to Nan Madden from the Minnesota Budget Project. Next, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. Appreciate the opportunity to testify. You have heard in earlier testimony and letters to the committee about the importance of taking bold action to respond to the challenges that everyday Minnesotans are facing. Property tax refunds are a powerful tool to reduce one of the costs of housing and move toward a stronger and more equitable future. Thank you for making such a strong statement in your division report that property tax refunds for homeowners and renters should be a priority for this year's tax decisions. And I want to thank Representative Joachim, Representative Marquardt, Representative Gomez, and Representative Ambaje for your work on this issue. The renter's credit changes in this bill would benefit renters in every part of the state. They're aimed at several important goals, including reducing barriers so that more folks who are already eligible receive the property tax refund they qualify for, simplify the income calculation for purposes of the credit, making it easier for renters and for the department to process, providing larger property tax refunds for many currently eligible households and allowing more renters to qualify, and getting those refunds out to renters much sooner, reversing a timing shift that has been in place for many decades. All of this happens while still maintaining the sliding fee structure of the renter's credit that prioritizes those with the lowest incomes and folks whose property taxes are particularly high in relation to their incomes. The proposed changes to the homeowner property tax refund also prioritize folks whose property taxes are a bigger part of their family budgets and some of the lowest income homeowners as well. These property tax refund expansions would provide a needed economic boost for Minnesotans struggling to make ends meet, whether they be workers, families, seniors, or people with disabilities. Thank you for making them a priority in the division report.
Thank you, Ms. Madden. I think I'll jump next to Michael Dahl from HomeLine.
Thank you, Chair Joachim and members of the committee for allowing me to testify in support of House File 4064. My name is Michael Dahl, and I'm the Public Policy Director at HomeLine. HomeLine provides free legal, organizing, educational, and advocacy services so tenants throughout Minnesota can solve their own rental housing problems. Our main program is a hotline that offers free, confidential legal advice to tenants throughout Minnesota. We have advised over 280,000 households since beginning 30 years ago, and we currently field approximately 1,500 calls each month. The first thing I want to note is that many of our clients are in a desperate struggle to hold on to their housing. A report from the Minnesota Housing Partnership, the State of the State's Housing 2021, notes that 22% of all renter households who can find a home pay more than 50% of their income in rent. Why? In part because Minnesota currently has a shortage of over 105,000 units needed for extremely low-income renters. The Minnesota Housing Partnership also shares that the cost burden disparity of renters is for renters of color are stark. In Minnesota, 44% of white renters are cost burdened. In contrast, 58% of Black renters pay more than they can afford on housing. The rent is too high. Minnesota is seriously lacking in number of homes needed, and wide racial disparities exist. As for House File 4064, converting renters' credit into a refundable tax credit and using a more common state income tax determination process would increase the number of renter households who would receive the credit that is actually already theirs. Under the current system, over 120,000 of those who are eligible for the renter's credit do not know that they qualify for the credit or do not know about the credit or that they may qualify. We also applaud the fact that an estimated 36,000 more renter households would become eligible for the refund income tax credit. Lastly, we appreciate the large majority of those receiving a refund tax credit will see a substantial decrease in their state taxes. We regularly advise Minnesota renters about their current renter's credit property tax refund, so we look forward to furthering conversations about how this transition of this magnitude will ensure that no one falls through the cracks. Thank you for allowing us to testify in support of House File 4064.
Thank you, Mr. Dahl. I think we have time for one more testifier. Mr. Hill from the Minnesota Association of Convention and Visitors Bureaus. Please proceed. State your name for the record and please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Todd Hill with Hill Capital Strategies, and I'm representing two clients today, the Minnesota Association of Convention and Visitor Bureaus and Hospitality Minnesota. I'm here to address two concerns with provisions in House Call 4064 as amended. The first is the language on page 90, lines 6 through 15, which grants the city of Woodbury the authority to divert lodging taxes away from the longtime agreed upon use for marketing and promotion of tourism to instead support capital projects. As I testified a few weeks ago, we oppose the use of those lodging taxes for anything other than supporting tourism and marketing. And I would also draw your attention to the language on page 70, lines 1 and 2, which repeals the sunset of the Plymouth diversion of their local lodging tax. MACDBs and Hospitality Minnesota are disappointed this bill attacks the longstanding partnership between Minnesota lodging facilities and the promotion and marketing of tourism. Would also like to remind the committee that the Plymouth Sunset was put in place as an olive branch to the opponents when that diversion was adopted in 2019. It was done as an attempt to alleviate the concerns of the MACDBs, Hospitality Minnesota, and the local business community. As you consider advancing these provisions, would just like to remind the committee of the devastation COVID has had on Minnesota's hospitality industry, and specifically our hotels and MACDBs. Our local MACDB budgets have been hurt as local resources tied to the rental of hotels and motels have disappeared over the last 2 years. A recent study of Minnesota's hospitality industry conducted in partnership between the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis and Hospitality Minnesota continues to paint a rather bleak picture for Minnesota's hospitality-related businesses. The recent analysis suggests the industry has lost over $15 billion in revenue and the equivalence of 249 days of business activity since the beginning of COVID. While losing that revenue, Minnesota operators continue to see their cost increase and the need to pay employees, rent, insurance, and utilities. The situation is made worse as the industry has 32,000 less workers today than they did before the pandemic. Financial data suggest our hospitality-related businesses have a long way to go before they are fully recovered. The Federal Reserve study also showed 52% of Minnesota hotels experienced lower winter revenue than normal in Q1 of 2022. 46% of the hotels in Minnesota project lower
than expected. I hate to interrupt. I'm sorry, that's been over 2 minutes. Can you wrap it up?
Yes, I would just say at the time when the hospitality industry faces so much uncertainty and years of debt, now more than ever, we need to make sure we're investing in the marketing and promotion of Minnesota, not divesting these funds for capital projects. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. We'll move the other two testifiers until Wednesday. By then, too, if there's any amendments, please try to get them in by Tuesday at 6 p.m. to be cognizant of our staff time. And with that, members, we will see you on Tuesday. We are adjourned.